This is Whitley Strieber. It's Coast to Coast AM, sitting in for George Nuri tonight. We've got a great show for you. Richard Dolan's going to be with us to talk about disclosure, those missing Rendlesham Forest UFO documents, the missing Roswell documents. Why are all of the missing documents coming up? All of the biggest cases, all the documents have been lost. We'll find out. Then later, somebody you've never heard before, Mark Booth will be with us. The secret history of the world. We know the history of the world we were taught in school. We know there are secret societies that have had a lot to do with what happens. What happens behind that curtain? Mark Booth knows what happens behind that curtain. This has been really one of the most extraordinary weeks in modern history, a tremendous earthquake in Japan, floods in the northeastern, in the eastern United States, from Maine all the way down into the Atlantic seaboard. There has been so much going on, revolutions everywhere. We're also going to be talking about a possible supernova coming, some changes in the lunar orbit, and some changes in Earth's axis. So this is going to be quite a show tonight. It's going to be not something you've usually heard. What I want you to do tonight, strap on your seatbelt. Get ready for a long and incredible ride, because we're going way, way out there tonight, and I'm so happy to be with you. I love doing Coast. I love it when they call me and invite me to come in here and join you for a great night of high adventure at the extreme edge. We'll be right back. This is Whitley. We're back. Richard Dolan's going to be with us in a couple of minutes. Will there be two suns in the sky by 2012? Well, that is a very fascinating, amazing question, and it's a serious question, according to some scientists. Beetlejuice, remember Beetlejuice, that great movie a few years ago, many, many years ago, actually? Well, Beetlejuice is also a star, and Beetlejuice is running out of gas. That's right. It's running out of fuel, and as a star runs out of fuel, at first it begins to get smaller and smaller, and scientists can see Betelgeuse doing that. Then suddenly, something goes wrong inside the star, and it explodes into something huge, something the size, for example, of our entire solar system. Betelgeuse, in a matter of minutes, would go from being just another star in the sky to being something the size of a second sun. It would send a shower of neutrinos toward Earth. There would be gamma rays. It probably wouldn't be dangerous, and in fact, there is even the possibility that it might increase the amount of gold, silver, and uranium on Earth. In any case, it would be a very, very dramatic event, and they're saying it could happen as soon as next year. This means that it has happened. It has happened 640 years ago, because Betelgeuse is 640 light years from Earth. Now, if that wasn't enough, a group of Italian scientists have just published a paper stating that the eccentricity of the orbit of the moon is changing, and they don't know why. Now, Betelgeuse isn't going to blow us all away. The moon isn't going to crash into Earth tomorrow. But I have to ask myself a question, and I think we should all ask ourselves this question. What in the world is all of this building to a head for right in 2012? I am on record as saying I did not think that the 2012 scenario, the 2012 story, the prophecy of December the 21st, 2012, was going to be any big deal. But clearly, we are moving toward a lot of change. For example, the Japan earthquake tilted the Earth on its axis by a few centimeters. Now, that's not unusual for a great earthquake. It will tilt the Earth on its axis because it moved Japan by 8 feet. Therefore, it changed the weight of the Earth, the distribution of Earth's weight, and the axis tilted a little bit. However, since 2004, the Sumatran earthquake tilted at about 2.76 inches. The Chilean earthquake tilted at about another 3 inches. So we've gone close, pushing toward 6 or 7 inches in axial tilt since 2004 because of these great quakes that keep occurring. And we have to ask ourselves a question. Is this tilting causing the Earth to become more unstable? Is that why we're having more great quakes? Well, if you look at the statistics, it turns out that we actually aren't in any kind of swarm of great earthquakes, that these happen fairly regularly. The difference is now they are usually happening in populated areas, heavily populated areas, because almost every place is heavily populated. So we notice them a whole lot more. Could it lead somewhere, perhaps to another quake near the quake that just happened? Could there be a destabilization maybe on the west side of the Pacific, on our side of the Pacific? The only known fault along our side of the Pacific that could let go that dramatically is the Cascadia subduction fault off the course of the Pacific Northwest. There's no evidence of any activity on that fault line, but then again, there was no evidence of any activity on the fault line that just went, nor was there any evidence of any activity on the fault line that went in the Sumatran earthquake. So we can't know these things. We just have to live with them. We're going to be talking to Richard Dolan in just a couple of minutes, and we'll be back with him. Richard is, of course, I think it's very exciting. We're going to have a tremendous time together, and he and I have known each other for years, and one of the things we're going to be talking about a lot is this, and I want to get this out before I even get him on the show so that you can be thinking about this. Rendlesham Forest, this was a UFO event that took place back in 1980 in Britain. It was one of the great UFO events. If you've listened to Linda Moulton Howe on this radio program, you know that she has been talking to people who actually were there, who have now come forward with detailed witness testimony about what happened to those U.S. Air Force personnel on that base at that time. Well, that has to be one of the single most important groupings of UFO documents ever acquired by any intelligence service, second only to another group, that is the group that were acquired during and after the Roswell incident, which I don't doubt happened because a member of my own family was involved in reassembling the debris at Wright Field in 1947, and his commanding officer, General Arthur Exon, a dear friend who was later commandant of Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, said to me plainly, everyone from Truman on down knew that what we had found was not of this world within 24 hours of our finding it. However, those records, when the General Accounting Office attempted to find them for Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico, sadly deceased, some years ago, every single trace of them had been illegally destroyed. Now, the British archives release a massive number of UFO documents, and guess what? Not a single Rendlesham document can be found. When we get back, that's the first thing Richard Dolan and I are going to talk about. We don't have Richard with us yet. Okay. Shall I bring Richard on right now? Okay, so we'll bring Richard on right now then. I'm sorry, I don't do this very often, and I'm missing the cues a little bit. But so, Richard, are you with us?
I am indeed. Hello, Whitney.
Oh, great. I'm very glad. Well, terrific. Let's just start right in. I think that most of you know a little bit about Richard Dolan. Richard published a huge study called UFOs in the National Security State in 2000. It is the first volume of a two-part historical narrative of the UFO phenomenon, the finest history of UFOs unparalleled ever written. The records of more than 50 military bases are covered in relating to violations of sensitive airspace by unknown objects. It is a truly extraordinary study. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the great Apollo 14 astronaut, called it monumental. While our mutual friend, Dr. Hal Pudoff, the director of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Austin, said it's a must-read for serious students in the UFO field. Now, Richard, with his friend Bryce Zabel and my friend Bryce Zabel, has published a new book called AD, After Disclosure, with a foreword by our old friend Jim Mars, author of Rule by Secrecy, that gets into the question of what happens if there is disclosure? What happens after disclosure. Richard, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Whitley. It's a pleasure to be on here with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. And I think that before, let's go with Rendlesham and with Roswell, because I find this shocking and so blatant. I can't believe that this is just some sort of an accident.
Well, indeed. Actually, this gives me an opportunity to mention that I've written two volumes of history, and there will be a third. So the two volumes become a trilogy in the making. And in that second volume of history, I wrote a good 10 or 12 pages about Rendlesham myself. It is one of the most intriguing and compelling cases in the history of the UFO phenomenon in the modern era, without a doubt. It is Britain's most prominent UFO case. And as you just pointed out a few moments ago, it has very strong parallels to Roswell. Now, over the last few years, the Ministry of Defense in the UK has periodically released their UFO documents to the public. And some of them have been very interesting. Others, I think, very overrated, in my own opinion. I think it's clear that the MOD's motivation in doing this is simply to relieve the bureaucratic strain of having to answer all of the Freedom of Information requests that the UK public has been asking them about UFOs. Because the fact is, everyone in the world is interested in UFOs, and any government that's got information on is going to be hounded about it, and no exception here. So now we get to Rendlesham. You know, Rendlesham is one of these cases now. We've known about it. Well, it happened over 30 years ago. It is the case that keeps giving. And the information that we've gotten about it over the years has come out by bits and pieces, drips and drabs, and like the Chinese water torture, drop, drop, drop. It is now so powerful. There is so much information. More and more keeps coming out. And so now we have it. In this latest release, we learn that actually 10 years ago, in 2000, there was a search by Ministry of Defense record staff, and that was when they discovered that the defense intelligence files from the years 1980 to 1982, that includes the Rendlesham case, had been destroyed, even though the other files from the prior and subsequent years survived. And this is exactly what happened with the Roswell investigation,
right?
Roughly 20 years ago, as you just pointed out. In fact, at that point, Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico looked into it, and he discovered the General Accounting Office, which was Congress's investigative arm, looked into it, and they discovered that all the records from Roswell Army Air Force from late 1946 up until, I believe, early 1949,
yes,
were inexplicably destroyed without any reason given.
And illegally. Illegally as well.
That's exactly right. And so now with the MOD, we have the same situation with Rendlesham. It just so happens that earlier today I wrote to my friend Nick Pope, who worked at the MOD and ran the UFO desk there during the early 90s. And Nick is always very gracious. Gentlemen, he's always been very good with me. And
yeah, that's right. And Ann and I love Nick. We had actually had dinner with him in London a few months ago. And
he just
folks,
got
I,
married.
What? Just before he got married.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go ahead.
To a wonderful lady. Anyway, so I asked him earlier today, you know, Nick, what do you think the deal is with this? And he's actually not 100% sure, I can say, but he does believe overall it's more of a screw up than a cover up. Of course.
I don't believe
always,
it.
He's always said that. So, and I love Nick.
Nick is
sure
a wonderful. He's really diplomatic. But if it hadn't happened with the Roswell documents, also, I would say maybe that's correct. I do not believe it. I think they were intentionally removed in both cases. And I have to ask you this, Richard: how much else has been culled from those files of cases that no one has ever heard of and doesn't know to look for?
Well, excellent question. I'm not sure if we're ever going to find the answer to that. I will suggest one of the reasons that I think the MOD files on Rendlesham might have been taken out has to do in part with the whole UFO element of it, obviously. But there is another part of this that's highly politically charged, and that is the fact that that base had nuclear materials, almost certainly, we've gotten this from every source except officially the MOD and themselves. In other words, nukes were at that base. They were not supposed to be at that base, according to the account by Charles Halt, who was the deputy base commander at the time. An unknown object shone a laser-like beam down through the dirt, through the hardened bunker, all the successive layers, down into the ordnance itself. And in the words of Charles Halt that he gave in a private interview with my friend Peter Robbins and Larry Warren, who was a soldier there, he said that that adversely affected the ordnance. But the point is that there were not supposed to be nukes there. It's a sensitive issue to this day. Even Nick, who's no longer an employee of the MOD, but he will not explicitly state that there were nukes there. But everyone knows there are nukes there. And so I wonder, and I can't really know this for sure, but the fact that that was also there might have had a contributing factor in someone's decision to take those files out.
Well, something like that must have been true, but it doesn't explain the Roswell, the reason to take out the Roswell files. If there were certainly nukes at Roswell, but they were supposed to be there.
Yeah, clearly. Absolutely. The Roswell case, I'm so glad you brought this up. I'll be dealing with that historically in my next volume of history when I cover all of this. But it's a crime against the public, to be honest with you. All of these are crimes against the public.
Yes.
In the sense that, look, we live here too.
Right.
The whole world is not supposed to be a national security state. The whole world is supposed to be a free world, and people do have a right to know what's going on in that world. And when you have a case with the MOD where obviously the most spectacular case in the UFO history of that country, key intelligence files are just gone. Well, that's something that we really should be concerned about. And incidentally, a few years ago when the MOD released other files relating to Bentwaters / Rendlesham, this spectacular case, all that they released at that time was just a whole bunch of, yawn.
Right, you know, nothing.
Nothing at all. It was all data that had been released previously, a lot of duplicate documents, like kind of triplicates, quadruplicates of certain documents. It was a lot of fluff and a whole lot of nothing. So in this release, really, we had the potential for something that was truly going to be a contribution to our knowledge, and instead we come up empty.
And the sort of slavish media each time is careful to point out all of the funny stories.
Oh, yeah, the big hoax.
The big hoax and the practical jokes, et cetera, and so forth. And these releases of documents are themselves a kind of hoax, aren't they? I would think that what they're doing is they're releasing anything that doesn't matter.
I agree with you, and I believe this for some time. The British government's history on UFO information is actually more repressive, or as repressive at least, as that of the United States government, in my own opinion. All through the 60s and 70s, especially in the 70s and 80s, I guess I should say, when in the U.S. at least there was a glimmer of information coming out because of freedom of information. Not so in the U.K. at that time. The United Kingdom took a much longer time to have any kind of openness on this. There were official secrets acts in effect at the time that were absolutely stifled this, and the UK attitude publicly was just not saying a thing. Now, that has changed subsequently, but really the only thing that we have seen is this type of bureaucratic move on their part, really, I think, simply to relieve the burden and giving up reports. Occasionally there's something in there, here and there, that is actually noteworthy. Recall, of course, the fascinating case of Milton Torres.
Right, I was just going to bring Milton Torres up. I think that was the single most important thing they've released so far.
Yeah, maybe. That's certainly absolutely the most memorable, and it is a fascinating case. And there have been some other ones, and even in this current batch, there's just so much to go through. It's going to take years, but looking over the summary and glancing through some of the documents, there is some interesting information that's been released here. We certainly should not ignore it. I won't ignore it.
No.
But in terms of here's what's missing. All right. What you get, first of all, are a lot of policy statements. You get a lot of public inquiries, people reporting their sightings. All that's fine. What you don't get is any evidence of internal investigations of UFOs themselves. That's what's missing.
So right.
It's like, you know, there stuff's coming in and no one's investigating anything going out. So, and I've got to think there's something going on. There's someone's got to be investigating something.
When we get back, we're going to talk more about the Milton Torres case and ask Richard a question. Is there a hostile element here? Is one of the secrets that we've been trying to shoot him down? We'll be right back. We're back. We're going to be talking to Richard Dolan again in just a couple of minutes. On my website, unknowncountry.com, in the Out There section today, the Jerusalem UFO, you might remember this from a few weeks ago, an extraordinary series of UFO video came out from Jerusalem. Videos taken from two different positions that both showed precisely the same thing happening at the same time as an object came down, moved slowly over the Dome of the Rock, made a flash, and then shot away. Now a third video has emerged. One of the things we're going to be talking to Richard about is the desperate attempt to debunk this and why it might have been so important. Also, later tonight, Ann Streber is with us. And when we go to the phones, she will be able to answer questions from Close Encounter witnesses and abductees about your experiences. Remember, Ann is the person who read all of the letters that you guys sent us, and she read every single one of them at over a period of many years, 20 years. And she knows more than anyone else on Earth about the Close Encounter experience. Also, my book Hybrids is coming out on April the 12th, and don't miss it. This is exactly what does it sound like it's about? Well, that's what it's about. I had a lot of fun writing it, a very interesting book, and it's a very interesting time to bring it out because just a couple of weeks ago, a representative of Hewlett-Packard said, "We have the right stuff to build brains right now." Where are we going in this world of ours? Things are changing so rapidly. It is just absolutely astonishing. And a listener pointed out to me, I was mentioning Beetlejuice this coming, perhaps next year, turning into a supernova and being a second sun, that there is a lot of video on my own website, once again in the Out There section, of strange, what appear to be sun dogs or ghost suns near the sun being taken in different parts of the world. These are probably not actual celestial objects because they would be affecting the sun dramatically if they were that close. But what is happening to our atmosphere that these peculiar sun dogs would be appearing? Gosh, there's so much to talk about these days, almost too much. I guess we all signed on to live in interesting times, didn't we? Well, welcome to an interesting night. When we get back, Richard Dolan's going to be back with us. His book, AD, After Disclosure, written with Bryce Sable, The People's Guide to Life After Contact. What if it happens? It could. We'll be right back. This is Whitley Strieber. We're back with Richard Dolan. Richard, when we left the air, we were just about to talk about the question of UFOs in conflict with our planes. And why don't you begin by telling us the Milton Torres story as it emerged from secret documents about 2 years ago.
Yes, exactly right. Milton Torres in the late 1950s, 1957, was a Air Force, U.S. Air Force fighter pilot. He was stationed in the U.K. Over near East Anglia, facing the North Sea. He was told to scramble his jet fighter because an extremely large object, he was flying an F-86 Sabre jet, outstanding jet fighter. He scrambled to intercept this object, which was over the North Sea, and his orders were to shoot it down. So he never had a visual on the object. This is a key part of the case. But he also, like his counterparts on the ground, tracked this object on the radar. And as he said, it was absolutely enormous. It was like the size of an aircraft carrier or larger, as he said. He was scared, he admitted, but he was prepared to fire on this thing when it suddenly just went poof and it zipped off. He didn't. He said it didn't disappear. It flew off at an incredible speed, very high rate of speed.
Well, so exactly like the Jerusalem UFO does in that video.
Yeah.
Shoots well, off
exactly.
at an incredible rate of speed. I've seen many videos of that happen. But
correct,
go ahead.
Correct. And, of course, in this case, he never got a visual of the object. But he was satisfied that there was something there. His superiors apparently were satisfied because when he landed, he was debriefed very thoroughly and told that he was never, ever, ever going to speak of this incident again, ever, for the rest of his life. And he never did. He was going to take this to the grave, except that a couple of years ago, when during one of the releases of the Ministry of Defense files, the British, the military description of this encounter came out.
Right.
So the whole thing was sort of outed, as it were, and media came up to Milton Torres, said, did this actually happen? He realized, well, I guess it's out, so I can talk about it, and he did, and he's made many, many interviews since that time. Everyone who's watched Milton Torres, I had the pleasure to meet him several times. This is a man who is absolutely rock-solid honest. And you can see the emotion when he relives this. It was a very traumatic and dramatic thing in his life. And I think just the fact that he was able, finally, after, God, half a century, to be able to talk about this was very emotionally cathartic for him. So it obviously happened, and the question is, of course, what did he see? There were some suggestions among the skeptical crowd that what he had seen was an experiment in electronic warfare, and the reason that they suggested this simply is because he never got a visual. But actually, it doesn't look like that. There was one program that was suggested that was supposedly part of the CIA that was supposed to be the cause of it, but it turned out that program was called Palladium, didn't start until at least 5 years later.
Yeah.
So there really are no good candidates to explain his sighting except, well, he had a UFO experience. And here's the thing. When you go back through U.S. military documents that have been released from the 40s and in the 1950s, we have many cases of admissions by senior U.S. officials that there's someone flying in our airspace that's not supposed to be doing it, doing things that are not explainable.
Right.
It wasn't Soviet. It was not the Soviets. So the question is, who the heck is it? I think the best, my personal favorite of these, is the famous Chadwell memo of December 2nd, 1952. And H. Marshall Chadwell was the scientific director of intelligence for the CIA at the time. And he wrote a memo to his boss, the director of the CIA, Walter Beadle Smith. And what Chadwell said was that sightings that are going on at this time convince us that something is going on that must have immediate attention. He says, sightings of unexplained objects at great altitudes traveling at high speeds near major U.S. defense installations, and here's a direct quote, are of such nature that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. In other words, it's a flat-out admission to the boss of the CIA that we're not dealing with weather or natural phenomena, and we're not dealing with any known aerial vehicles. We're dealing with unknown vehicles of some sort. And they weren't ours, and they weren't Soviet. So what are you left with in 1952? And on top of that, we've got case after case of confirmed encounters in which U.S. pilots encounter these things up in the
right,
air.
Right, in the sky, many pilots.
And they chase them. And we've got a number of confirmed cases where military pilots were vectored in to investigate these objects, and every time they're outclassed, every single time.
You know, one of those cases was very close to me when I was a boy because it was the Mantell incident Colonel, I believe he was Mantell, had crashed after going too high and losing control of his aircraft because he lost he didn't have oxygen. Well, the commander of that base was cashiered, and he lived a block away from us in San Antonio, and I used to play with his son all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that family, they felt like they had been just very ill-treated by the Air Force because the Air Force had not told the truth about what happened. They didn't think.
So their opinion was that, what, he chased a UFO?
That he chased an unknown object, that it wasn't a balloon or a mistake or anything, and that why he had flown so high was not clear. But it shouldn't have resulted in this man's career being destroyed.
Yeah, the Mantell case is interesting. Thomas Mantell was a captain who had flown in World War II. Now, it is said that he was not a fighter pilot until just very recently. In other words, during the war, he had fought, he had flown, I think, larger non-fighter type aircraft. And so the argument was made that he wasn't quite used to the aircraft he was in, saw a Skyhook Navy balloon. I'm not saying this is the case, but this is it. And that he chased it, not knowing what he saw, and then got what they called anoxia, which was lack of oxygen because he went too high.
Right.
I've gone back and forth over this case. I've looked at a lot of, there was a lot of Blue Book data from the Air Force Project Blue Book, and I read those case files. I think that there's a couple of possibilities. It is possible that he chased the UFO. I still leave this as very, very likely. But I'm not sure if I can give it a slam dunk one way or the other.
Well, yeah, it's true. It is a case that is rather equivocal, but it was one of the reasons that this was a subject of interest to me when I was a kid.
Well, it was a spectacular case.
There is a
man died.
A man died, yeah. There is a couple of books out by a man named Frank Fischino, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Indeed, yes.
And I know Frank, and I've interviewed Frank, and I'd love to have him with me on Coast some night. He, in fact, I will do that, or on Dreamland, on Unknown Country. But he believes that there's been quite a bit of conflict, that there have been many attempts to intercept and fire on these objects. Where do you come down on that overall?
What he did is fascinating, and I would love to have had access to his book when I was writing my first volume of UFOs and National Security State all those years ago. What he wrote was a book called Shoot Them Down,
right?
Subtitled The Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952. Now, anyone who studied this phenomenon in any detail knows that 1952 was a big year, maybe the biggest.
Huge.
Absolutely, and there were military encounters all through that year. Many, many attempted interceptions. We know about this. We've known about it for years and years. Now, a lot of those cases came out. It's an interesting quirk of history. We just as easily could not have known about most of these, but for the fact that retired Marine Corps Major Donald Kehoe, one of the early important UFO researchers,
right,
who had a lot of connections within the Pentagon at this time, was able somehow to get Project Blue Book to declassify a large number of these aerial military encounters with UFOs. It was said that a few months after this, some senior general essentially screamed out, "How the hell did Kehoe get those reports?" But the fact was that they were released. It was too late, and he published them immediately in his next book. So we knew that there was a lot going on. But what Frank Fischino did is he gathered together an enormous number of newspaper articles. And one of the things he pointed out was there were a large number of airline crashes of that year.
In that year, that's right. There were a large number of airliners that mysteriously, including one case where I believe an airliner took off and it just didn't work in the sense that lift did not occur.
I believe that I recall that exactly.
At LaGuardia Field at the time, right. Yeah.
So, you know, what he does is he brings you right into that period of time, and it's exciting to go through it. And more importantly, from point of view of research, it points out that in 1952, it really could have appeared to a lot of people that there was an actual war going on between us and them, whoever them happened to be.
Yes.
And that the war wasn't going particularly well.
But perhaps it's more like we were fighting a war, and they were trying to figure out what in the world were we doing.
Right.
I get the impression, personally, that there's a really enormous gulf between us, a huge gap. And I think you do, too. I know in After Disclosure, which, by the way, I thought was just a terrific book that you and Bryce Abel wrote. And so, folks, you do pick this up if you want to. If you want to actually know something about this subject, one of the first places you need to go is Richard Dolan. And, Richard, by the way, you're going to be speaking soon somewhere. And if people want to meet you and to listen to you in person, I think where would they go?
Well, I got a bunch of things coming up. In the immediate future, I've got next week, I'm going to be in Lawrence, Kansas, at a very interesting conference called the Oz UFO of Kansas Reykjavik Summit, excuse me. This is in Lawrence,
okay.
Kansas.
I'm with you. Go ahead.
I would just tell people to go to ozufo.net. That's
okay.
ozufo.net. I'll be there. My co-author, the intrepid Bryce Zabel, is going to be there with his lovely wife, Jackie. Robert Salas, who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1967, is going to be there. Frank Fascino is going to be there. Stanton Friedman is going to be there. Stephen Bassett will be there. Sam Maranto, my very good friend, is going to be there. Peter Robbins, Don Schmidt, Butch Witkowski, Jesse Marcel Jr.
Oh, that'll be fascinating.
And Charles Holt and Rosemary Ellen Guiley. I think that's all.
And Charles Holt, of course, is one of the Rendlesham witnesses, one of the most important ones.
Absolutely.
I'd love to get back to Lawrence. That was where a dear friend of Ann and I, William S. Burroughs, used to live, and we used to drive back and forth between New York and Texas. And
you knew Burroughs?
Oh, yeah. And I came up to our cabin looking for the visitors. And much to his annoyance, he did not get any action, but his assistant did.
The author of Naked Lunch.
Yeah, that's right.
The man himself, the legend. I should mention Kim Carlsberg will be there, and she has a very new book, which I'm a fan of.
Yeah, that's right.
The Art of Close Encounters. So.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book. Kim is it sounds like an absolutely terrific conference, and you'll get a chance to talk also with Frank Fascino, because, you know, this is an important, something is wrong, Richard. Something is profoundly wrong. Here we are, 60 years on, and people of so many prominent individuals, astronauts, scientists, pilots, the list goes on and on. Leslie Keene's new book just lists one of them after another.
Indeed.
And yet, there is this bald-faced denial. And let me ask you a question here. I'm going to go back to Jimmy Carter. Before he entered office, as you point out, actually, in AD and After Disclosure, Jimmy Carter said he'd seen a UFO. He knew there was something in all of this, and he wanted to get the answers, and he was going to do that, and he was going to tell everyone the truth. And when he was in office, it was hardly referred to. Then, interestingly enough, and I might be wrong about this, I think it was Stanton Friedman. It was one of the major UFO investigators. I asked him, did you ever talk to Carter about this after his time in office? And he said, yes, I did. And he refused to discuss UFOs at all. He wouldn't say anything.
Yeah, that was Stan. I think they ran into each other at Logan Airport, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating, and it's rather chilling, because here's a man, before he gets into office, he's eager to tell all. After he comes out, he won't even talk about them.
Well, I would love to discuss this. I have some thoughts on this as well.
Well, we're going to discuss it
when we get back
in a few minutes, but go ahead right now.
Well, I think that the secrecy on UFOs, this gulf that you refer to, and is absolutely, it's a chasm. It's the clock is ticking on it. It cannot last forever. Nothing lasts forever.
No.
Not even the most pernicious of lies, and this one will have its day as well. Regarding Jimmy Carter, I looked into this a lot as well, especially when I was doing my second volume of history, and also Bryce and I revisited this when we wrote AD. Carter was really quite open, of course, as a candidate about having seen a UFO, and it was a dicey thing for him to do as a candidate, you think about it.
Well, it was. Look at what happened to Dennis Kucinich. He was eaten alive when he mentioned it.
absolutely. But not so Jimmy Carter. I think that the country was in a different mood. They were ready for this guy. And he had that winning smile. He had some long hair. He was an outsider. It was perfect. 1976, it worked. He gets into office. Now, you know, Carter really never went crazy as a candidate in talking about UFOs. He mentioned it a few times.
Right.
And it was when people asked him, and he said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did see one. And sure, I mean, when I become president, I'll look into it. And he didn't say, you know, we're going to bring utopia here and we're going to get end the secrecy. He said, I'm going to look into it. I'll do my best. And the evidence is that his office looked into it a little tiny bit.
When we get back, we're going to be talking to Richard about the big, huge question. What is wrong? We will be right back.